broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Resolving the Palestine Zionist conflict and the wider Arab-Israeli conflict is probably the single most important thing that could be done to bring about a peaceful, stable, productive, and joyful Middle East.
That's Rami Khoury, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Rami Khoury on war or peace in the Middle East. The ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians is in its first phase. Some captives have been released, with more to follow. Aid trucks are delivering desperately needed food, water, and medicine to the besieged Palestinians. What the future will bring is uncertain. The situation is fragile. What is certain is the Palestinians have endured disproportionate death and destruction. Israel has a powerful military and the backing of the United States. The BBC says, after 15 months of war in Gaza, the conflict is as bitter and intractable as ever. The consequences of so much destruction and death will be felt for a generation at least. The long overdue ceasefire may stop the killing, but won't end the conflict. Our guest today is Rami Khoury, a veteran journalist who has reported on the Middle East for decades. He was executive editor of the Beirut Daily Star, and before that, editor-in-chief of the Jordan Times. He was the founding director of the Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He's co-author of Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters. I talked with Rami Khoury in mid-January. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
The Middle East region is in turmoil. For decades, it has been devastated by wars, coups, assassinations, invasions, and occupations. I'm wondering about cultural attitudes informing political perspectives of the West. How are Arabs, Iranians, Turks, and other Muslims seen through the prism of what Edward Said wrote about in his classic book, Orientalism? Clichés and cultural stereotypes within a colonial context and imperial political framework. How about all that historical baggage that goes into factoring issues?
You know, all of that is active today and even more obvious and visible than it has been for many, many years, even decades, because of the American-funded, British-assisted, German-enabled Israeli genocide. In Gaza, we've had the worst level of human atrocity anywhere in the world, I believe, in the last maybe half a century. So there's been a couple of bad things in Africa, but not the systematic physical and human destruction and perpetual pain inflicted on innocent civilians living in tents, including starvation and burning them and killing them and destroying all their schools and hospitals. We haven't seen that level of cruelty and destruction and savagery, and the West has pretty much gone along with it, with a few exceptions only. And this is the most glaring evidence of what is the real relationship between people in the West, or God, let's say governments, to be fair, because people are more reasonable. Governments in the West, most governments, with only a few exceptions, and the people and movements, political, cultural, social resistance, all the different movements across the Middle East, not just the Arab world and Palestine, but also Turkey and Iran and other places. And, you know, the ceasefire negotiations, which have been going on and off for months, they've already also clarified for the Western world, and you see this in the news media. I mean, I was watching the Western media carefully from my home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and listening to the two American presidents, Trump and Biden, talking about it. Every sentence they said should be a footnote in a new edition of Said's Orientalism book, because they essentially talked about the Israeli families who have hostages in Gaza, and they either didn't mention the Palestinians at all, or just perfunctorily mentioned saying, well, the humanitarian aid should increase. And clearly the message is, Israel is what counts. Not all Jews support what Israel is doing. In fact, probably a majority of Western Jews are opposed to what Israel is doing. But for American, British, and German and other politicians, this is all that matters. And this is a continuation of not just the last 75 years of the Arab-Israeli-Palestine-Israel conflict, but really the last three centuries or so, since Napoleon started attacking Lebanon and Egypt in 1798. We've had nonstop Western military, not just involvement, but physical attacks, military attacks and occupations, and colonization and colonialism, culminating in the last major Western imperial colonial movement, which was Zionism, which was supported by very few Jews when it started in the late 19th century. But then the British, being the godmother of all colonialists and savages in the region, supported this process to create a Jewish home, Palestine, where 93% of the land was and the population was Palestinian Arab, including my family in Nazareth. So this is a long process. This is a lingering historical phenomenon of Western governments mainly, and many people, but not all, but the governments mainly looking at the Arabs as inconsequential or even non-existent people, and looking at the Palestinians particularly as totally invisible and even dangerous people who need to be eradicated. And this is what the Israelis have now done in this last phase in the Gaza genocide. It's really astounding to see all of this happening, not just what the Israelis are doing. That's not a surprise, because Zionism from its conception was aimed to drive out the Palestinians, as many as possible, keeping in mind the Palestinians were 93% of the population in 1910 or so, to drive them out, but also to kill as many as possible, and then to create a Jewish state that dominates not just Palestine, but the region. And we see this, and I say dominates, it doesn't mean that it occupies the region, but what the Israelis are doing now and what they've done in the last couple of years, they attack Syria, they attack Lebanon, they attack Iraq, they attack Iran, they attack Yemen. Anybody in the region, doesn't matter if they're Christian, Muslim, whatever nationality, organized groups, civilian supporters, whatever they are, the Israelis with their massive Western-provided and funded military might have the right, in their views, to attack anybody in the entire region, destroy their societies as they've done in Gaza and South Lebanon, destroy their military capabilities as they've just done in Syria. And this is the wider threat that Zionism poses to the region. And that's why so many ordinary people around the Arab world and the Middle East, Arabs and non-Arabs, support the Palestinians, and why so many people around the Global South support the Palestinians. And one of the striking consequences of the last year and 4 months has been the massive international popular support, and many governments around the South, to support the Palestinians in their struggle to achieve their rights. Not to destroy Israel, but to achieve their rights as Palestinians living in a Palestinian state alongside Israel, enjoying absolutely and simultaneously equal rights with the Israelis. Not secondary residual half rights as servants and day laborers, and like the African Black Africans did in South Africa for many years, until they achieved their liberation as well. So you've got all of these dynamics and many, many others happening at the same time. The most terrible one, in my view, in the Western world, and the United States is the leader in this, is the Zionist manipulated and supported dynamic that tries to not just silence Palestinians or voices that speak for Palestinian justice, but to criminalize expressing support for Palestine and to criminalize being a Palestinian. So if you walk around with a Palestine pin or a keffiyeh around your neck, which that is now in many parts of the U.S., a crime. And it's become a crime because nincompoop lawmakers in the United States who have no concept of what's really happening in the region and what's happened in the last century, they just go and do whatever Israel and AIPAC ask them to do. And this is why you end up with laws that make it a crime to boycott Israel because of its apartheid actions and genocidal actions, reaching a stage where it's a crime in some American states and cities to teach a course on Palestine at a university or to hold a conference. So this is the secondary line of damage that Zionism is doing, besides what it's doing in the region in Palestine and Lebanon and other places. It's also eroding the foundations and the core principles of Western democratic, pluralistic, constitutional, republican, small r values, free speech, equal rights, access to the law, etc., etc. And these are being slowly eroded along with the vicious Israeli-American-led attempt against the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. So what you're seeing is that the Zionist movement perpetuated by the state of Israel now, the government of Israel, is slowly degrading and destroying the values of global coexistence and human rights guarantees for all people that emerged after World War II because of the genocide against the Jews in Nazi Germany. But that period is over, and the Israelis are the ones who are leading the assault on those principles, and most of the Western world is doing nothing about it or going along with it quietly. So this is a real, real dangerous but historic moment. But in the face of this, you have almost the entire global South and probably half of the global North supporting the Palestinians, opposing what the Israelis are doing, taking Israelis to court for their genocidal actions and other things. And in the United States, you see, for instance, the student movement, which is led by American Jews in many, many parts of it. And you have this tremendous global support for this peaceful protest against what Israel and its Western supporters are doing. So we're in a new battle now that has come out of the Arab-Israeli or Palestinian-Zionist conflict. And this is a new phase now where the battle lines are in the media, in education, and in the law. And this is really a fascinating and important phenomenon because it's in those areas precisely where Zionists don't have the advantages they used to always have in the legislatures and presidential offices in the Western world. You know, the Zionist lobbying effort, which succeeded amazingly to create a Jewish state and a 93% Arab land. A spectacular book by Israeli historian Ilan Pappe has just documented the whole history of Zionist lobbying in the West, mainly in Great Britain and then in the United States. And it focuses heavily, almost exclusively, on the levers of power in the executive branch and in the congressional, parliamentary, or legislative branch. That's all they really care about, the people who make power. They don't care if people in Madison, Wisconsin, or Boulder, Colorado, or Syracuse, New York, where I went to school. They don't really care if people there start criticizing them and analyzing them and pointing out their criminal activities, because that doesn't influence the policies. And we saw that now, that in the genocide in Gaza, it's the political decision makers in Washington and in London who made the decisions to totally support the Israelis. And that's what they care about. But that is starting to also fray at the edges. So in the U.S. Congress now, You know, you can probably expect 100 senators and congressmen and women to support a reasonable motion to criticize Israel, curtail its human rights and other violations, and deny it American support so that it can't keep doing a genocide while American laws are being challenged and broken, because American law says you can't provide foreign aid to people carrying out atrocities and human rights denials and pogroms. So this is fascinating now to see how over time, you see it in public opinion, clearly 70% of Americans roughly are wanted ceasefire, and they maybe 55, 60 want limits on American military supplies to Israel. These are huge historical changes among the people. You don't have that level of criticism of Israel in the official systems of government, but it's slowly happening in the Congress and even in the executive branch. You have, you know, probably had a dozen or so officials in the U.S. resign because they couldn't keep behaving the way that their government was telling them to behave. And therefore, the changes that are happening slowly but steadily. And more importantly, they're being led in many cases by young American Jews, progressive Jews, and they're spreading all over the world. And this is a slow process. It takes time to mobilize people to be able to pressure officials to change policies. So that's a long answer to your short question, but there's so many things happening at the same time that it's important to try to, I think, understand them in that complete context.
The Israeli response, almost automatic, to these criticisms of what they're doing, what their policies are in the Arab Middle East and specifically in Palestine, is that it's all self-defense. We're surrounded by enemies who wish us harm, and any state would have to protect its citizens. That's their line. Put yourself in their shoes for a second and sort that out.
This is a line that has emerged really since the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel. Before that, when Zionism started in the late 19th century, very few Jews supported it, but enough of them did, and they were good enough at lobbying British officials initially to make progress and create a Jewish state in Arab Palestine. And this is important to note that their argument there was that the Jews needed a safe haven from European pogroms and anti-Semitism and massacres, which probably makes sense. But you can't give them a state by stealing the land of other people, which is what the British did in Palestine. But after 1948, you had conflicts, structural ongoing conflicts between Israel and many Arab states, and then the Palestine resistance movement as it started to grow and develop starting in the late 1960s, and now has developed in other ways in tandem with Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Ansarullah in Yemen and support from Iran and other places. So there's a wider ring of resistance and opposition to Israel. And it's not just opposition to Israel, the axis of resistance. They're opposing what Israel's doing, but they're also opposing what Western hegemony is trying to do. So it's clearly packaged in the context of opposing Western colonial domination and aggression, which is manifested most dramatically in the Middle East by what the Israelis are doing. And this Israeli argument that the Israelis have the right to defend themselves on paper is correct. Every state has a right to defend itself. But there's two issues that the Israelis ignore, that there are laws that were created after World War II, the rules of law and humanitarian law and all kinds of crimes of war and stuff. These laws were designed to protect innocent people because of the way the Jews were mistreated by the Nazis, and to make sure that this never happens again. The other point is that just as Israel has a right to defend itself, so do Palestinians under occupation. So do Lebanese, so do every... So look at all the people that Israel has attacked in the region, and they all have a right to defend themselves too. So this Israeli double standard, or the Zionist, let's call, because not all Israelis support this, but the Zionist double standard of Israel having the absolute, pervasive, and eternal right to use any force it wants to attack any group or person or country it wants in the region or further afield by assassinating, you know, people in other countries, that this logic of Israel has reached an extreme now that it is starting to generate criticisms around the world. And slowly you're getting situations where legal efforts are taking place in Europe and North America and other places, making it difficult for some Israeli soldiers and officials to travel. They're afraid to travel because they're going to get arrested and sent to the International Criminal Court. So the idea that Israel has a right to protect itself is true in principle, but in practice, it is used as a vehicle to assure perpetual racist apartheid savagery that has now reached the level of plausible genocide, according to the International Court of Justice. And this is the dilemma that Israel has faced. It's kind of ironic that at the 100th anniversary of the League of Nations mandate that came into force in Palestine, whereby the British got the League of Nations to create a mandate for the British to run Palestine, and in the mandate was embedded the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which said that Britain will help pave the way to create a Jewish state or a Jewish homeland. And that was in 1924. And here we are just after 2024, 100 years later, we've seen the consequences of this. It took a long time for the Israelis to reach a level of savagery and aggression against people all over the region and domination over Western constitutional systems of governance, whereby the Israelis, through their very astute and aggressive lobbying, which includes enticements and threats and other things, where they could get people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to join the savagery and to celebrate the savagery, to say that, you know, they will always support Israel, whatever it does. And this is why Kamala Harris, in her incompetence and lack of humanity, lost, because she was seen to be, by Americans, not just Arabs and Muslims, but by many Americans, she was seen to be part of the genocide. So again, that argument of we have a right to defend ourselves is good for public relations when you're appealing to people who don't know anything about the region, whether, you know, in different parts of Europe or the U.S. or in rural communities or in small towns, or where people just don't follow these issues. They don't know the facts. And therefore, it sounds great to say this. They say, oh, yeah, of course you have a right to defend yourself. But then the critical point to keep your eye on is the officials in, you know, Colorado and San Francisco and Kansas and Pennsylvania, all over these officials who represent their American constituents in Congress, how are they voting? And who are they getting money from to run their campaigns? And if they criticize Israel, who is opposing them to drive them out of Congress? And this is the dynamic that now has reached a serious new peak. And we saw several Congress people lose their seats in primaries because through AIPAC, the big Israeli lobby in the U.S., the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Israelis attacked electorally and financially two or three people like Cori Bush and others, and they lost. This happened before. You go back to Paul Finley and Pete McCloskey and Chuck Percy. There's other people 20, 30, 40 years ago in Congress who similarly, when they dared to speak out, even mildly asking for Israel to stop killing Palestinians or whatever, or occupying land, the lobby turned against them and they got voted out. So the American top level of the political system, the Congress and the executive in Washington, have been conditioned by lobbying, by the Zionist groups and the State of Israel, to not challenge Israel. But it's not working because, like I said, you could probably get 100 members of Congress now who in the Senate and the House who would oppose Israel, who would vote against it. And this is increasing. Every time Israel does something terrible, it increases. And it's increasing because ordinary Americans have seen the truths of what Israel and Zionism are doing, and they don't want to support that. They don't want to be a part of it. So these incremental changes at the local community level across the United States and in many parts of Europe are really the critical driving force of the political evolution of Western support for the state of Israel. There's still ironclad support for a secure Jewish majority state of Israel, but there's also increasing demands at all levels of government and society that the Palestinians also must have their state with equal rights to the Israelis, not subsidiary or secondary rights. If they behave, they get more land or something. That was tried in the past in Camp David and Oslo, and it doesn't work. The trend in the United States and many parts of Europe is to demand equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians, but political leaders or politicians, let's call them, are afraid to speak out too boldly on this because they'll lose their seats. And they've seen this happen every time there is a national election in the U.S. The Israeli pro-Israel lobby targets some people, has a lot of money, and causes some people to lose their office. This is the new battlefield in electoral politics and in the legal systems in the U.S., the court challenges to make sure that basic fundamental principles of American constitutionalism, freedom of speech, equality before the law, due process of law, that these fundamentals are safeguarded and not whittled away by pro-Israeli policies. Now, fundamentals may be whittled away by American officials in the new government coming into power in the U.S. That's a separate question. If a majority of Americans supports a candidate like Trump and says, you know, we don't need equal speech, equal rights or free speech, or we should limit what some people say. Well, that, if the U.S. decides that on the basis of domestic American issues, nothing to do with Israel or foreign policy, that's a separate question. That becomes a more serious challenge to the American people. I'm talking about the dangers that are already being implemented because of the very severe and sophisticated and effective pro-Israel Zionist lobbying efforts that are happening. These are all now challenged openly. You can follow people on Twitter and Facebook and I don't know what, that show you who AIPAC is giving money to. It's called AIPAC Tracker. And you see this candidate in Kansas or Illinois or wherever has received $250,000 or $700,000 or $1.5 million from AIPAC over the last few years. So this is all coming out into the public now, which is another novelty. This never happened in the past. And really, it's only in the last, I would say, 10, 15 years that we've seen this kind of public sharing of knowledge about precisely what the Zionist lobby is doing, the Israeli lobby, and why it's wrong, and what people should do to counter it. And there's an incredible amount of work happening now around the United States at community level, through churches, through political groups, through progressive groups, intercommunal group, blacks, Hispanics, Jews, women's groups, students, labor unions. I mean, this is super important. And people are studying this now to understand how do we keep this going? How do we maintain the fundamental goodness of American society, which has been whittled away by the combination of internal dominance of extreme capitalist and often racist and anti-Semitic forces. So this is an unbelievably important historical juncture. And there's about 8 or 10 different serious things happening in different domains. And it's a little bit overwhelming to try to capture them all. But I think slowly people are doing this, are realizing the connections among all of these different domains, the way effectively that activists and ordinary citizens can behave if they want to oppose the Israeli genocide and the American